This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, we'll hear from the owners of Precision Construction, the construction team that built the first rocket landing pads on the West Coast.
Our insurance company, they look at our website and they're like, so what about this Hyperloop? They get really nervous. So we always have to talk them down and remind them that we're doing normal construction and nothing that we're doing is going to get anybody shot off into outer space accidentally.
Also, on Peace, Love, and Pets, you'll meet a retiree who spends a lot of time helping other people find their lost pets.
She was dragging a leash that entire time. I can't tell how many miles of barbed wire fence I walked or drove and checked, concerned about Lucy getting snagged on something.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, August 19th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with working lunch.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jim D'Antona, CEO for the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce and your host today, and this is the Working Lunch. The San Luis Obispo Chamber has formed a direct partnership with KCBX to bring you these working lunch discussions. Each month, we will sit down and meet with a member of our community to talk about doing business on the Central Coast. We will be bringing you conversations with folks who are doing interesting things in impacting the business community that help them meet the challenges of our current business environment. We hope you will join us for these conversations every month on KCBX's Issues and Ideas. Today, I'm so pleased to be sitting down with Carl Valancourt and Stephanie McDonald. Carl is one of the three founders of Precision Construction Services, and Stephanie is the Senior Human Resources Manager for Precision. Precision Construction Services is an award-winning commercial and federal construction firm serving clients throughout California and the Western United States. Hello, Carl and Stephanie. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Precision Construction has been trusted to build some of the most noteworthy projects in the world, including the world's first Hyperloop, the first rocket landing facility on the West Coast, and the first steel fiber reinforced tunnel in the United States. In May, the U.S. Small Business Administration named Precision the 2024 Prime Contractor of the Year for the Pacific Region, the federal agency's top procurement award. In 2023, Precision's owners were named the Small Business Administration's Small Business Persons of the Year for California, one of the agency's highest overall honors. Carl, that's a pretty impressive list of accomplishments over the last couple of years. But before we go digging into all that recognition, start us off with how Precision Construction came to be. How did you and your partners come up with the inspiration and idea for the business?
That's a really good question and something that we like to remind ourselves about as we get deeper and deeper down this rabbit hole. The origin story behind Precision was really driven by us wanting to stay on the Central Coast and all coming from various parts of the construction industry, not being happy with the status quo within the industry, how construction companies are run, what the dynamics are between contractors and clients, owners, what the dynamics are between designers and contractors and subcontractors. And we thought then and still think today that there's a better way to do business. There's no reason why we can't be more collaborative and inclusive. You know, it's an industry that's been around literally forever, and we've been stuck in the past for a long time. So that's really what we've been focused on, is changing the culture and the approach within the industry in our own small, humble way.
Certainly one of the things we hear from business owners all over, trying to find how to do business differently, but also wanting to stay on the Central Coast, mm-hmm. which is obviously key. How many employees are now a part of Precision Construction?
We're about 50.
I referenced above the first rocket landing facility on the West Coast. That's at Vandenberg Space Force Base. That must have been very early on in your company's life. How does a smaller startup figure out how to be part of some of the most important projects in the nation?
Well, I think we owe our clients the debt of gratitude for the opportunity. So we started out because we didn't have any capital to start the business. We just had our willingness to roll up our sleeves and get after it. So we didn't have the wherewithal to start a construction company when we first began. We were starting out in the cost consulting realm. We were good at helping clients figure out how to build things, in some cases, things that had never been built before. And we had relationships, so we had people that trusted us, but we didn't have a contractor's license, we didn't have trucks, we didn't have tools, we didn't have superintendents, right? So it was the three of us in Jared's living room trying to figure out how to make a business work. And we started out doing consulting. And one of our early clients was, you know, a pioneer in the commercial space industry, literally trying to figure out how to build things that had never been built before, all within the context of this industry that's stuck in its ways and has a very rigid approach to problem solving. And that's really what we see construction as, is six-dimensional problem solving, right? You've got your X, Y, Z, time, cost, and people, right? Like, there's a lot to worry about, and it gets complicated in a hurry, and that's with projects that have been built over and over and over again, and there's some institutional knowledge. The reason why clients really gravitated towards us in the beginning, and what, you know, our best clients really value in us today, is this solution-focused approach, right? We see the value we bring to the table as being able to solve problems, sometimes problems that they didn't know existed. And we try really, really hard not to burden our clients with our problems, right? Our job is to solve the problems. So that's one of our core values, is to stay solution focused and keep that mindset at all times, which is a challenge. But that's really why we got these opportunities to begin with, and what's made us successful in the early stages of the company. So, I mean, to circle back to an answer to your question, our ability to help our clients plan these types of projects led to them coming back to us once they were dissatisfied with what the industry was bringing to them, in terms of, you know, we had a plan that we had come up with, we had a budget and a schedule that we had worked with the client on, and then you had a bunch of established contractors who said, no, you can't do it that way. It's going to cost way too much money, and it's going to take way too long. And, you know, they ended up hiring us to do it because we said, yeah, we'll stand by our plan, we can make this happen. And that was just with, you know, three of us sleeping in a job trailer out at Vandenberg and trying to sort it out, like literally drawing things in the dirt with the engineers. And like, that was real design build. So when there's a will, there's a way. And I think the industry in general is lacking a lot of will. And that's one of the things that really drove us in the early days, and I think still differentiates us today.
And I love that idea that the work you're doing is problem solving. It's not, you know, I lay concrete, I put in rebar, right? That becomes part of the solution, but you're solving problems the whole way. And one of the things, the Hyperloop work, which is really cool. First, maybe for those who don't know what the Hyperloop theory is, can you give a summary of what that is?
Yeah, so in a nutshell, the idea is to create a vacuum tube. So there's no air resistance to whatever vehicle is traveling in the tube, and levitate the vehicle so there is no surface friction from wheels or tracks or whatever the case may be. So the main theory behind it is that it takes some energy to get a vehicle moving, but then it takes very, very little energy to keep that vehicle moving because there is no air resistance, there's no surface friction. So the theory behind it was, instead of building the high-speed rail as a solution to, you know, getting people from LA to San Francisco quickly, is the genesis of all this, why don't we build a Hyperloop and be able to do it in a matter of 30 minutes rather than, you know, however many hours on a train? So that made a lot of sense, still makes a lot of sense, but obviously it's a huge infrastructure requirement that requires some proof of concept before people are willing to get behind it. So that's what we got engaged to do, was help figure out how to build the first nearly at scale test facility for this technology.
In my days in Los Angeles, where this conversation was happening, and all of us were super excited about this theory of what it could be, and again, you're talking about some crazy level stuff, right? If you're just joining us, I'm Jim D'Antona from the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, and this is Working Lunch on KCBX. And we are here with Carl Valancourt and Stephanie McDonald of Precision Construction Service, and we are talking about doing work here in Slo County. But here again is this pretty young company taking on this project that could have just huge impact in our world. How did you get into that?
Yeah, the relationship and the trust came from that Westpad Landing Zone project at Vandenberg, showing that we could be successful in this type of endeavor. And then the Hyperloop presented the same types of challenges, right? They had the largest engineering and construction company in the world engaged to help them figure this out. And the more, you know, deeper down the rabbit hole they went in terms of working out the details, the more issues they came up with about why it was going to take too long or cost too much or be too complicated. And so the client said, well, we know some guys who might be able to help. And so they brought us into the planning stage of that. We were able to sort out some issues. We worked really well with that large engineering and construction firm, and we were able to strike up a really great relationship and a partnership with them. But, you know, we ended up being the co-general contractor on that project after initially being brought in as just a consultant. So that was actually the project we got our contractor's license for. That was the first project we pulled a contractor's license for. So I still remember, and we actually still get questions now from our insurance company. Whenever they see our annual renewal applications, they look at our website and they're like, so what about this Hyperloop? They get really nervous. So we always have to talk them down and remind them that we're doing normal construction and nothing that we're doing is going to get anybody blown up or shot off into outer space accidentally. So it's been an adventure for sure.
It's not just huge infrastructure projects, right, that Precision has been successful in developing. I read you also had a part in rehabilitating the Ahwahnee, the historic landmark hotel inside Yosemite that was built in 1927.
Yeah, and Yosemite in general is really near and dear to our hearts. So my partners, Eric and Jared, and I, we met rock climbing. That's how we originally became friends. We have a lot of reverence for Yosemite and everything involved with Yosemite. So we jumped at the chance to do projects in the park. And that has a lot of complicating factors, mainly because it's considered a remote location. It's far enough away from everything that the logistics of construction get pretty complicated. And so with the Ahwahnee, that was really gentle compared to the work that we typically do or had done at that point. And it really is about the craftsmanship and the attention to detail. And, you know, we had a good plan for how we were going to do that. And we had the right people that, you know, could pull it off. We also had another project already in the park. So we had the space at that job site to actually work. So one of the things we had to do was replace these log railings on the outside of the hotel. And, you know, they were just rotted from being in place for the last, you know, almost 100 years at that point. So we brought in new logs, but then had to mill everything on site and work everything so that it matched the craftsmanship that had been used to install it in the 20s. So that was really, really just a cool opportunity, not a big project, but a really cool opportunity and a great resume piece just because it showed that we were capable of that type of work. And then we've gone on to do quite a bit of historic restoration work and renovation work throughout the federal government projects and sites, not just at Yosemite. These things all kind of snowball.
The last 2 years has seen you get some of those amazing accolades. Precision was mentioned in Inc. magazine as one of the 5,000 fastest growing companies in the country. The U.S. Small Businesses Administration names you the prime contractor of the year for the Pacific region, and Small Business Persons of the Year in 2023. So what do you owe that kind of success to?
It's easy. It's our people. You know, like, we set vision and we like to think that we set an example for how we want to do business. But all of our core values and the things that we really use to drive the company forward on a day-to-day basis are all modeled after what we've seen be successful from our people. When we started, we had our own original set of core values that Eric and Jared and I sat in a room and came up with. And after about 2 years, we realized that that's obsolete, right? It doesn't matter what the three of us think. It's like what has made and is making Precision successful now and in the future, right? So we took a really hard look and it took us the better part of a year meeting for hours every week to come up with our current set of core values and like, what do we really believe in? What do we think really matters and moves the needle? And at the end of the day, all these awards come from the fact that we've been able to find great people who can model those core values and continue to exceed expectations with our clients, in this case, the federal government. But yeah, it makes us feel really proud that we've been able to identify those things that matter and the right people to help us do it. And we take that very seriously, and we'll continue to going forward.
If you're just joining us, I'm Jim D'Antona from the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, and this is Working Lunch on KCBX. And we are here with Carl Valancourt and Stephanie McDonald of Precision Construction Service, and we are talking about doing work here in Slo County. One thing we always like to talk about here on the Central Coast, the challenge of finding those skilled, knowledgeable team members. You say 50 employees, and we know that talent acquisition and retention is always a challenge. And so, Stephanie, how have you tackled that challenge of finding and retaining talent?
Yeah, it's a problem that's not unique to us here on the Central Coast. Every employer, I think, faces this at one point or another. And you really have to take a pronged approach. There's no one-size-fits-all solution to finding talent. We have a great pipeline from Cal Poly coming out of the construction management department and others for early talent. The tricky part is that mid to senior level, where we're pulling from other areas more than likely. So one thing that we did early on when I joined Precision was to work with a compensation partner and come up with a compensation philosophy that aligned with the Los Angeles market so that our benefits and our salary both were very competitive to other large organizations that we see ourselves competing for talent with. And, you know, our benefits as a small business and a small employer align almost perfectly with large employers in our industry. And the owners have done a really great job in ensuring that, you know, our employees have what they need to be successful. Even the flexibility of where people work has really impacted our ability to recruit some specialized talent, especially within the federal contracting arena. We have remote employees that work for us in, you know, project management roles, in superintendent roles, and having that flexibility and, you know, not having to relocate really puts us in a place to recruit that specialized talent and bring those people onto our team, but they don't have to relocate their entire family, which more than likely is going to be the case if you're mid to senior level in your career.
Yeah. You are one of our Blue Diamond family-friendly workplaces, which is nearly the highest level we have. You're talking about remote work, the benefits packages, and that's something special on the Central Coast is sometimes we feel since we're remote, we don't have to compete. But it looks like you've really put the effort and energy in that as owners, because there's obviously a cost to that, right, Carl? I mean, it's not free. Are the benefits outweighing the cost there?
Yeah, I mean, it is a heavy cost, and it takes, I mean, Stephanie works really, really hard to not only attract, but, you know, recruit and retain the people that we have that really drive the business. And the bottom line is, you know, we have great talent on the Central Coast, but we don't have enough for everybody. All the companies that are here doing good work and growing, right? There's a lot of business here on the Central Coast, and our industry doesn't lend itself as well to remote work as, say, a software companies would. When we talk about remote workers, we're talking about people who still go to a job site every day. They just don't have to come to San Luis Obispo. We have quite a bit of work in the LA metro area, for example. So we have superintendents and project managers who don't have to relocate, but they do have to drive to a job site. So it's not like they're sitting in their living rooms most of the time. So it's a little bit different in that regard, but it does open up a lot of possibilities versus, and I'm sure you've talked a lot on the show and just in general in your role at the chamber about how hard it is to attract people to come to the Central Coast, not because they don't want to be here, but the logistics of it between childcare and the trailing spouse's employment and everything else is just a tough nut to crack for people who are more senior in their careers, probably have families, have networks of friends. You know, there's a lot more than just saying, oh, that's a cool opportunity. I'd love to go back to SLO. Let me jump in my car and drive up there, right? That would be ideal, but most of the time it's like, well, what is my wife or my husband going to do? Where are my kids going to go to school? How am I going to buy a house? Like, these are all things that we talk about all the time. And, you know, that doesn't make it easy, but, you know, we chose to be here, so we kind of made our bed. We got to figure out how to lay in it, so.
I love the idea of remote not mean, you know, just working out of your bedroom or your office. It means you're going to have people traveling, but they're not having to necessarily relocate. So I always like to end our discussion with a bit of forecasting about the future. Since you're getting a great view of future-focused development and work, what are the economic opportunities or challenges you see coming down the road for us here on the Central Coast?
I think near-term challenges, you know, it's the interest rate environment and private developers building commercial projects on the Central Coast, right? I think it's not stopped by any means, but I think it's a little bit slowed by the interest rates and just the changes that makes to a developer's pro forma when they're laying out how a project's going to work. Construction costs have gone a little bit nuts ever since COVID. So all of that kind of needs to normalize, or people need to get a better handle on where things are and where they're going before that side of the market will pick back up to where it was in prior years. But it's still, I wouldn't say it's weak, it's just weakening. And then on the government side, so we do a lot of federal government work, and we do a lot of work with the utility companies, and that's part of our business model and making sure that we have resilience baked in, right? So, you know, our federal work, our utility work is a lot less volatile when it comes to market cycles and the way things typically move. So we just think that's a good foundation for the business, but then we love to be able to do these exciting private projects. So we're definitely not closed off to that, but we don't want our business to be feast or famine. So with all of the work that's coming at Vandenberg, that's a massive opportunity for our entire region across almost all industries. Construction is going to be a big beneficiary of that as they spend billions and billions of dollars over the course of the next 25 years to bring Vandenberg up to the level it has to be in order to support the future of commercial space launch. But all the surrounding areas are going to be impacted by precision manufacturing and these other companies coming to the area. So we're really, really excited about that. The other thing that we're also focused on, though, is the future of Diablo. I think whether that ends up being some other form of energy production or something else entirely, there's going to be significant redevelopment work out there, and that's going to be a major impact on our economy. And we're working for PG&E now. We're doing our first project out at Diablo, so that's really exciting as it's still run by PG&E for the foreseeable future, but you know, we know that might change, and there's also opportunity that comes with that.
So if folks want to learn more about your projects or how to become part of the Precision team, what's the best way for them to learn about that?
I think the best place to start is our website. Our marketing team has done a phenomenal job revitalizing our website, and you can learn about our projects. And if you want to learn more about becoming a part of the Precision team, you can email us directly at careers@precision.services, or you can connect with me on LinkedIn directly. I'm always open to having even informational interviews with prospective candidates if we don't have a position posted on our website that you're actively interested in. There's always future growth with our company, as we've seen over the last 5 years. And again, would love to have, you know, a connection.
That's fabulous. Give the website.
Precision.services.
Great. Carl and Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing this incredible work that you all are doing. To you, our listeners, thank you for joining us for this important conversation. On behalf of Carl Valancourt and Stephanie McDonald of Precision Construction Services, KCBX, and I'm Jim D'Antona for the San Luis Chamber of Commerce, we hope you have an amazing week. Keep making our community a wonderful place to live.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, Peace, Love, and Pets.
Welcome to KCBX. This is Peace, Love, and Pets. I'm Robin with Woods Humane Society. My guest today caught my attention recently on social media when a video was shared of a rescue of a dog named Lucy after a fatal car accident. I thought it would be great to get him in here, share the story of Lucy, how he got started with Strategic Pet Recovery. Please welcome Sean Deanhart to Peace, Love, and Pets.
Thank you very much, Robin. I'm happy to be here.
Good. Well, we're happy to have you here. And I love myself a happy ending story, hopefully. So hopefully you're going to share a couple of happy stories with us. Tell us a little bit more about yourself, your background, how you got started in pet recovery. And then please do us the honor of sharing the story of Lucy.
Oh, of course. Well, I'm a retired guy. I have about 30 years of work experience in nuclear security and information technology. So that's all in the past.
No big deal.
And I actually discovered rescue dog recovery by way of a news broadcast about a dog that went missing in the High Sierra back in, I think it was 2016, 2017 timeframe, and they were looking for volunteers. So I volunteered and I kind of got hooked.
I love when that happens. Yeah. Have you been doing it since then? How many years do you have under your belt there?
Actually, not too many. I think it's been about 8 years, about a year after that High Sierra adventure looking for a missing dog. I came home one day and checked my mail at the community mailbox, and there was a lost dog poster on the mailbox. And it was lost kind of sort of nearby my residence. And so I started down the path of looking for that dog. And from that time, I've been consistently looking and attempting to recover lost dogs.
Well, please share the sweet story of Lucy.
Yeah, Lucy. So sadly, Lucy's owner was involved in a head-on collision out on Highway 46 East at the eastern boundary of San Luis County. Another vehicle attempted to pass a semi-truck over the double yellow, and it hit Lucy's owner's truck head-on. And so there was a couple of fatalities, sadly. On board with Lucy's owner in his truck was another dog. They both had leashes on and inside the cab of his pickup truck. And so it was very much a nightmarish accident scene. There was fire, lots of emergency vehicles making that long run out there to try to do some good. Medical helicopter came around a little later. And after the accident scene was cleared, both the dogs were running around near the highway. Sadly, one of them succumbed to being hit by another vehicle on the highway and passed away out on the highway. And so after the accident and after that, one of two dogs was known to be dead, the status of Lucy was just completely unknown. And so it was about a full day later before I learned that there was a dog missing from the accident. And so naturally, with a little dog recovery background, the first thing I did is jump in my vehicle with some supplies and went looking for Lucy. And my first effort was to go to the accident scene, which was clearly marked by the burned pavement, and on both sides of the highway off Highway 46 east of Shandon. There were deep ravines, one of them much deeper, and it looked like the path that Lucy probably would have taken. And sadly, my first search was to look for either a seriously injured or possibly a dog that was deceased. So I was looking underneath shrubs, you know, tall grass, for a dog that might have passed away. But thankfully, I didn't find any dead dogs that day. And in fact, I went around, as I usually do, to contact and assertively stop basically anybody that's in the area. And it's not a well-traveled area off the main highway, that is. And so I learned of a sighting of Lucy earlier in the day that I was out there. And so I knew Lucy was alive. So that was great news. Mm-hmm. And so from that point forward, I started contacting many people, putting up posters and trying to figure out where Lucy was at. I met some ranch owners that had seen Lucy maybe 3 or 4 days after she'd gone missing, mm-hmm. which told me that Lucy had traveled a great distance off of Highway 46 south, much greater than any dog I've dealt with before under those types of circumstances. Mm. So I knew Lucy was on the run, but if one were to actually drive out to that area and stand among the hills, or some might call them mountains, and 8 miles, it's much greater. That's a line of sight, you know, as a crow flies. So probably in dog terms, Lucy probably traveled 16 miles one way and then 16 miles back. She would make a loop. And so we searched and searched. I saw Lucy with my own eyes a couple of times, but even at a 100-yard distance, she would just bolt and run the other direction. Sadly for me, Lucy was mostly making her trips on private ranch property, a huge, huge ranch in the area. And for whatever reason, the ranch owner denied me access to try to trap or follow Lucy. So that kind of put a dent in my effort. But regardless, Lucy was seen a number of times. A lot of great people, a lot of other great ranch owners came to help out, and including people that are working on the highway project on Highway 46 and 41, Caltrans employees and their contractors, all excellent set of eyes out there every day. So I got a number of sightings. And as the days pressed on, I figured, well, I'm in it for the long run. And did my usual thing, which is to set out, for example, what I call a camera trap, which is a cellular-based trail camera. So if something gets in front of the camera, it sends me a text alert, and I could see what's going on. And in front of that camera, I put out food, very smelly food, and a big bucket of water. Oftentimes when the dog has gone missing, it'll look for water before it looks for food. And Lucy never showed up in any of my multiple camera traps I'd set. I had set a large trap at an area she'd been seen a couple of times, and I would sit, you know, I never leave the trap set without me being present. So I spent countless hours during the day and night waiting for Lucy to show up. She never did, and again, she was on that ranch property I was landlocked out of. So this went on for a while, and then one night I'd just arrived home from looking for Lucy, and I noticed my cell phone while I was starting to have dinner started lighting up. And there was the good news. Lucy was safe. Lucy had traveled an incredible distance and over some significant terrain to go from where she was south of Highway 46 over to a ranch in Shandon. And thankfully, the ranch owner has some dogs, so Lucy warmed up to the dogs. And the amazing ranch owners there were able to secure Lucy, and they called a friend of Lucy's owner, and she came to pick up Lucy. So a happy ending. I always say it doesn't matter how a dog gets home, just so it does.
That's amazing. I love this story for so many reasons. Obviously a very sad, tragic story. We are devastated with the loss of life for the humans and the other pet. But I always believe that there is hope and possibilities in every situation, and that good people like yourself and the Caltrans workers, the ranch owners that were cooperative, they didn't give up hope and they found the value in finding Lucy. How important these pets are in our lives, and sometimes nothing else is going right and everything is hard, difficult, sad, stressful. But the one constant in a lot of our lives in this community are our companion animals, cat, dog, horse, whatever that is to you. But they fill us with so much love and joy. And I could only imagine this this owner who's dealing with medical challenges and probably financial burdens, and obviously through a very traumatic experience, he would have lost both of his dogs. How devastating and sad that would be to for the story to end with. But there's that glimmer of positivity and hope. Please tell us that they are reunited.
Yeah, absolutely, Robin. It was a couple of days into the search before I had spoken directly with Grant, who is Lucy's owner. Of course, he's in the hospital, pretty well banged up, having multiple surgeries and so forth. But he told me in no uncertain terms how important it is that his surviving dog is returned to him.
Yeah.
It's still emotional for me, too. Yeah. I actually consider it quite a privilege to be able to assist people and by whatever means, getting their dog home mm-hmm. safe and sound. It's really quite a privilege. Grant and his friends and family are remarkable people. And again, I can't underscore it enough, the ranch owners and others that help out during, whether it's Lucy's recovery or any other lost dog recovery, there's always people that stand up and make time to help out.
Yeah. And what a good girl Lucy is. What a survival story that she has.
Yeah, it really shows the manner in which a dog can survive. And a part I left out, which is was quite important to me. So the resilience of the dog is really quite incredible. I've seen this over and over again, yeah. But with Lucy, it's really been extraordinary.
If you're just joining us, you are listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Robin with Woods Humane Society, and my guest today on Peace, Love, and Pets is Sean Deanhart with Strategic Pet Recovery. Lucy is just one story of the many, I'm sure, that you've had. Too many. I mean, I wish we didn't ever need to have your services or people out there. But we do talk a lot on this show or at Woods. We talk a lot about pet reunification and responsible pet ownership and just hoping that everybody is microchipping their animals. There's fancy collars now that you can have trackers, which I'm sure you're a big fan of. Even collar and ID tags. You know, sometimes it's just a dog or cat loose in your neighborhood, a street or two down. But you're dealing with some pretty intense situations. And I also want to remind people that these animals, like this situation, was very traumatic. And just like it's traumatic for people, these animals are dealing with trauma and grief, and they're not necessarily acting like they do in their day-to-day life with their owner. We wonder sometimes, why is that dog running away from us? Or don't they know we're trying to help? But they are in a fight or flight mentality at that time, and they are fearful. They have just been through something horrendous. So talk a little bit about what you have learned over your years of being successful.
Sure. Well, for starters, if a dog goes missing, and it's away from home, whether it's run away literally from its home down the street and is out for a couple of days, or certainly if it's in a rural area or a wilderness area, which I often find myself in, a dog is going to be in a fight or flight situation. And so it's hypervigilant. And consequently, that fear status puts it in a mode where it may not and usually does not recognize its very owner. And basically, the dog has to smell the owner before it feels comfortable approaching the owner. So I've had many times with either observing directly or learning after the fact about how an owner of a missing dog yell out its name, you know, here Fido, or try to approach the dog with the wrong body language, and the dog runs off to continue being lost all over again. So one of the first things I attempt to coach people with when they have a lost dog is never ever yell for your dog, never chase for your dog, and then I will physically demonstrate a calming technique with body language. So if they do encounter their dog, to have the dog come to them, which includes having a slip lead and some food on them, sitting on the ground, so forth. So
I've seen so many videos of that moment where you can see the sniff where it registers, and they register. And sometimes it's pets that have been away from owners, sometimes days, weeks, months, sometimes years, where that sniff, once they get that, once it clicks, then they know that they are back with their loved one.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, for example, if I'm out searching for a dog, or if anybody's searching for a dog, as we know, dog's hearing is, I don't remember the exact percentage, but I want to say something on the order of 500% greater than human ears.
Yeah.
And so if I were walking and calling a dog, for example, well, that dog's going to be long gone before it would be within my eyesight. So I would always walk quietly while I'm looking for a dog. And I might stop and look and observe and continue, but I would never call out for a dog while looking for a dog because it's going to be long gone before I ever got within eyesight of it.
And what are some other tips that you have? And I know there were five reasons that lost pets are not found.
Well, the first is simply failure to take action, whether it's a cat or a dog. Most people say, well, you know, I'll wait for the dog or the cat to return home. You really need to just take a moment to check. And most of the time, the dog or cat is nearby and the problem is solved. But if you don't check, it could go for days. The next thing you know, you have no idea where the dog's located. So failure to take action is number one. Number two, in my view, is oftentimes actions taken are incorrect. You have to know what those correct actions are if you're going to go look for a dog that has gone missing. And number three is failure to follow through. A lot of people, because it's difficult, it becomes very emotional. People tend to throw in the towel way too quick, measured in sometimes hours, oftentimes a couple of days. And I would offer, when I first contact somebody about a missing dog, I'll try to assess the situation and say, well, it could be weeks. It literally could be months. but don't throw in the towel. Mm. My goal is to help you remain optimistic while we're out, you know, looking for a dog. Number four would be lack of planning. Even if you take 10 minutes to make a plan in advance. And then lastly is getting the wrong help. So we talked about, you know, don't yell and chase and all these sort of things for a lost dog. So let's say, for example, you put out a message on, I don't know, social media or Craigslist, hey, everybody look for my dog. Well, that's really getting the wrong help because you have not asked people or coached people what they are to do. You need to have back up to that plan. Say, well, you know, where I need your help is if you could look three blocks this way and three blocks that way, and be sure don't yell or chase the dog. And if you see people, ask them, hey, have you seen the dog? Show them the poster, this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to get help, make sure those helpers know what their actions are.
Yeah, and their heart's in the right place. Right. But again, we're talking about fear mentality for the animal and having 30 strangers by all yelling or making loud noises. That's probably not the way to attract a scared or nervous or injured animal. And again, a lot of times they may be injured in some ways and they're not thinking clearly as well. It sounds like, and I love this because we advocate for this, talking to your neighbors, which you're doing on a bigger scale, whoever you can see in some of these rural areas. But we shared just recently around 4th of July, something like 70% of lost pets are found within a mile of their home. And that's ones that are getting out the front door or the gates left open or runs out or got spooked by something like fireworks. And we advise those people, talk to your neighbors, walk around, make the flyers, a post on social media asking for sightings, those types of things. Just talking to people and sharing those photos. I know you're putting posters out on like remote fences that you would think, I don't know if anybody's going to see this, but you were able to talk to Caltrans workers, ranchers, farmers passing by. So those posters really do work.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Posters are probably the number one most effective communication tool to recover a lost dog, more awesome. So in my view than social media, robocalls on the phone, emails, whatever else exists.
Good old-fashioned lost animal posters.
Exactly.
Or found animals, too. Don't forget, if you find an animal,
right?
please get the word out on that, too. If you're just joining us, you are listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Robin with Woods Humane Society, and my guest today on Peace, Love, and Pets is Sean Deanhart with Strategic Pet Recovery. Well, tell me your very first story that sparked this amazing act of kindness that you're willing to offer.
Right. So one day I'm driving home and I stopped at the community mailbox to pick up my mail and there's a lost dog poster.
Yep.
Back to those posters again. And there was a big picture of a beautiful male German Shepherd named Paco had gone missing just a handful of miles from my house.
Okay.
So I thought, well, I've got some time. I'm going to go looking. And I gathered some information and I made a bunch of posters and I literally back then I would knock on doors. This is a rural area again. And I obtained a few sightings, but not many. When Paco went missing, it was a result of a traffic stop on Highway 46 east of Paso Robles. And during that traffic stop, by whatever means, Paco bailed out of the back seat of the vehicle. Paco was also dragging a long leash. And I got down to the mode of literally tracking Paco's, you know, paw prints in the mud and this sort of thing to find where Paco is located. After 6 or 7 weeks, maybe a little bit more, I was able to locate where Paco was at through some good communication, which happened to be in the hills surrounding a landfill, which is east of Paso Robles. So I contacted the landfill owner, who thankfully provided permission for me to put a trap on the landfill after hours. But oddly enough, I didn't own a trap because did I mention this was my first? And I called around and I realized, well, to buy a decent trap is about 2 months delivery time.
Wow.
And I don't think Paco wanted to wait around another couple of months. So I homebrewed a trap. I put up this camera trap. I described earlier a camera, food and water at the landfill. And I was so thrilled to check that camera. I had to check it physically, not remotely at that time, to see Paco's face. He looked pretty healthy. So I knew he's going to show up for food the next night. So the next night I put out my homebrew trap, which I hustled together in a day on the landfill. And I sat probably a good 150 yards away on a hilltop overlooking the landfill. Palco kept me waiting about 6 or 7 hours into the night where I could no longer actually see my trap. But I think around 11 p.m., maybe midnight, I heard a clunk and a roof. I ran down and there was Paco. And since Paco was out so long, the owner, frankly, you know, I respect the people, but kind of given up hope. I guess I should say I understand that. But I pulled up my cell phone. It was probably a half hour after midnight at the time. I called Paco's owner and he thought either I had been inebriated or pulling his leg or anyway, about 2 hours later, he showed up with his brother and was reunited with Paco.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you were hooked.
Absolutely.
And the trap worked.
The trap worked,
good
and I continue
job.
To use that old trap along with others to this day.
Oh, that's awesome. If you are just joining us, you're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Robin with Woods Humane Society. My guest today on Peace, Love, and Pets is Sean Deanhart with Strategic Pet Recovery. Tell us a little bit more. I know you did mention cats.
Yeah, it just happens that my wife and I think it started with my wife first, are big-time cat lovers, and we have rescued cats have been abandoned in the neighborhood and this sort of thing over the years. So we've had many, many cats, more than I care to admit. My wife has coached me just say, if asked how many cats we have three cats.
Perfect. I know what that means.
Won't add the multiplier. And so I learned a lot about cat behavior one time when a cat that we had was adopted by a nice lady that lives in rural San Luis Obispo. And on day two, sadly, the cat got out of her ranch home. And so I drove down to her ranch for a week trying to locate the cat. And I never was able to recover the cat, but the short story is I actually did a bit of a study of domestic cats in an area that is not too familiar to them. Mm. How far will they travel? And it taught me a lot about how to find other cats based on that search for that one cat. And so I apply that today if I go searching for a cat.
They can cover a lot of ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, they really can. And they are, you know, they have that instinctual kind of predator that kicks in.
Absolutely.
You don't charge for these services. You do this as a volunteer, which is amazing. I'm sure you can't help every story or situation, but I do know there's a handful of people like yourself, and there's Debbie and Jeff who are in South County. They recently, I think he just used his drone thermal camera to help a dog that was lost by Laguna Lake Park, and it was missing for a few days. The same thing, didn't recognize the owner's voice, but was able to get them reunited just at the last minute, and that's such a happy, successful story. And then there's a group called Doggy Days Search and Rescue that gets involved from time to time. So really, I love sharing different resources with pet owners. How can people learn more? And I want people to be able to watch Lucy's video. You have some great videos of some of your rescues.
Sure. I have a humble website, which is strategicpetrecovery.com. I can also be emailed at Sean@strategicpetrecovery.com, and that's S-H-A-W-N, Sean@strategicpetrecovery. And I do have an eclectic YouTube channel, which has a variety of different videos, but there are also some lost dog, lost pet, and some trapping videos on my YouTube channel, which if you just were to put my name in the YouTube search bar, it's Sean Deanhart, D-I-E-N-H-A-R-T. So there's more information there as well. And I just want to add that a large part of what we do, I would include Debbie and Jeff and others, is coaching. You know, a simple coaching on the phone is often the remedy.
Thank you again for what you do to help people and pets in our community. It was a pleasure meeting you. As for what's going on at Woods, we are busy, busy. Summer is always busy with kittens and puppies and lots of fun community events. In July, Woods did 216 adoptions, 559 spay and neuter surgeries. We brought in 258 animals in need. Over 800 volunteer hours were logged. 154 animals were fostered. And over 1,900 pounds of pet food were shared with our community partners and people in need, thanks to our community pet pantry. If you love what we're doing at Woods, this is a great time to support. In August, we have a double donation match. So right now, $20 becomes $40, $50 becomes $100, and that will help us help more pets in need. So head on over to our website for all things Woods. Check out our events calendar. Scroll through those adoptable pets, woodshumanesociety.org. Thank you for listening to Peace, Love, and Pets on KCBX. I'm Robin with Woods. And And don't forget, your new best friend is waiting for you at the shelter.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, an exhibit at the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art is shedding light on some hidden aspects of surf culture, including racism and elitism. Here's Amanda Wernick.
The exhibit spotlights the work of 9 artists from around the world. It combines photography, painting, filmmaking, and more to tell a story about how surf culture has affected people of color. The film Heaven by Tracy Moffat is playing on a TV in the background. With idyllic clips of the beach and men in tight bathing suits, the film explores voyeurism, consent, and sexism in surf culture. Gabriella Angotti-Jones is a Los Angeles-based photojournalist who also contributed to the exhibit. She's showcasing 7 prints from her photo book, I Just Want to Surf, which focuses on the Black femme surf experience.
I tried to look for people who had similar experiences to me, being either rejected from the surf world or feeling uncomfortable.
And Gotti Jones says she grew up in the predominantly white community of Capistrano Beach and initially felt excluded and discriminated against from its surf culture. She says she later reconnected with the community and found people with similar experiences helping her process depression and racial trauma.
I was able to meet up with a bunch of other people that looked like me and how they helped me process my depression, and I learned to love surfing again.
Her photos were mostly taken in Southern California, but also in other parts of the U.S. like Florida and New York. And Gotti Jones says one subject is a girl named Autumn who faced prejudice as a Black surfer.
I actually have a piece in the show, which is a picture of her laying on her board, and it has one of the embroidered words on it. She was harassed by a couple of white surfers in Rockaway.
And Gotti Jones says while her photos show racist undertones in the surf world, she also wanted to capture the happiness that's inherent to the sport.
I think people really want to see themselves, and they want to see joy, and they want to see like what the true core of surfing is, which is having fun and connection and community.
Hi, Emma. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. How's it
Emma
going?
Saperstein curated the exhibit. She says Angotti Jones's work shows there's still a lot of racism in surf culture.
Gabriella's work really grounds the show. Her work is really about visibility, about owning her rightful space in the water.
Saperstein says as a surfer herself, she wanted to highlight underrepresented voices in the surf world.
The motivation for the show is really like, let's think together about how to be better stewards of the space that we occupy in the ocean, how to make it a more inclusive environment, and navigate together some of the harder histories that come with the surf industry.
Other local contributions include 2 boards sculpted by shaper Shea Soma. One of his boards is placed in the center of the exhibit. It's a white shortboard, which expert surfers often use. It can be on the costlier side. Further back is a blue Wavestorm, a mass-manufactured and relatively inexpensive board for beginners. Saperstein says expert surfers can exclude beginners on local beaches. She says displaying the board's comments on this experience.
His insight and his thinking that's so connected locally felt really important in this project, to sort of challenge his practice and move it away from sort of the craft of making boards into sort of social commentary and critique.
Saperstein says she hopes the exhibit prompts local surfers to reflect on their actions.
I want people to leave the show with hope and joy, but I also want them to spend time in the show and really think about their own relationship to the water, their own ideologies that they perpetuate that are healthy or unhealthy for society.
Photographer Angotti Jones says the Whose Waters exhibit shows that surfing is becoming more inclusive, but also reminds people to address the realities of its culture.
These are things that can't be ignored when we go surfing or when we enter the water. And I think that's a really powerful reminder that surfing isn't excluded from the harder discussions.
The Whose Waters exhibit is at SLOMA until October 20th. For KCBX News, I'm Amanda Wernick.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio, and this is Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. Finally, from the California Report, people say one person's trash is another's treasure, and that's true at a landfill in Riverside County. Workers at the Lamb Canyon Landfill have started rescuing items to resell at a new store.
From KVCR in San Bernardino, reporter Madison Almond gave up her normal Saturday thrifting to go landfilling at the shop.
Normally when I go thrifting, I put on a sundress and sandals and head downtown. The dress code at the Found It Again reuse shop at Lamb Canyon requires sturdy closed-toed shoes and an orange safety vest. Dump trucks lumber by hauling trash. A few hundred feet away, the store is set up in and around shipping containers. About a dozen people browse the wares. Barbecue grills, kayaks, bikes, even some artwork. Jonathan Rodriguez drove about 20 minutes from Hemet to get here. He says he heard about it from friends and it was a not-miss shopping opportunity.
I'm really into thrifting, so I'm always looking for secondhand goods.
Rodriguez picks up a bag.
It is a Harley Davidson. It says it's a premium luggage day bag.
It's in good condition and costs $6.
I mean, anywhere else, that'd probably be a lot more, especially if name brand.
He gets it and some headphones for a friend. That's two less items going in the landfill, says Joe LaFoon, who's a county landfill worker and runs the store.
The idea here is to prevent as much tonnage going into the landfill and diverting it elsewhere.
The idea to create the store came up before COVID, but was delayed. LaFoon says workers here who sort drop-offs noticed that much of people's so-called trash was still in good condition.
Be surprised what people throw away.
There are dozens of bikes and old exercise equipment. LaFoon marvels at the rarer items, like a World War II footlocker and antique Chinese rice baskets. Sometimes he thinks,
it's like if the museum had a dumpster.
To set prices, LaFoon researches online what each item sells for used. He takes the lowest price he can find, then slashes that.
Right there I got sitting a $2,000 grill that basically somebody just upgraded, and now we just put a price tag of $12 on it.
25 cents gets you as many action figures as you can carry from a giant toy chest. And those bikes, $6. All the money from the sales goes to support recycling things like electronic waste and tires in Riverside County. The Lamb Canyon store is open the last Saturday of every month for just 3 hours. That means if you want something, you have to act fast. A lesson I learned the hard way.
The gentleman with your kayaks rolling away in the sunset.
I watched as the two red kayaks I had my eye on while reporting drove off atop another customer's car.
Yeah, I know, right? It hurts.
And it did a little bit. For the California Report, I'm Madison Ahmet at the Lamb Canyon Landfill.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.